Hey guys, before we get started, I have a big announcement. I'm writing a second book that will be dropping January 2021. The title of the book is Rebuilding Milo, The Lifter's Guide to Fixing Common Injuries and Building a Strong Foundation for Enhancing Performance. I wrote it to be the ultimate guide and solution to your struggles with injury and pain that we develop in the weight room. Now, over the next few weeks, I'm going to drop more information on the book and even ask for your help in voting on the cover. If you want to learn more about the book, you can head on over to Amazon.com and just search Rebuilding Milo. The pre-order button is actually already up. I am super pumped for this book, and I know you guys are going to love it. Now, without further ado, let's get to today's show.
Class is in session. You're listening to Squat University by Dr. Aaron Horshick.
Let's go!
Now, let's start the show.
Hey, what's up, podcast listeners? Thank you so much for checking out today's show. This is episode 95 of the Squat University podcast. The goal with each and every one of these shows is to bring you as much value-packed content to help you move better in the gym and in life, decrease your body's aches and pains, and help you reach your true athletic potential. Today's podcast is sponsored by Barefoot Athletics. Here's the deal. If you want to lift big weights with great technique, you need the right shoe. Now, for those of you out there that like to lift in a flat sole shoe like a Chuck Taylor, you need to check out the Ursa shoe by Barefoot Athletics. They have a wide toe box that allows you to naturally splay your toes out and use your foot like it was designed. No more cramming your foot into a narrow toe box and smashing your foot into an unnatural position, which, yes, happens with most Chuck Taylors. I've been lifting in them with almost any non-Olympic lifts for the last few weeks, and I just absolutely love them. They are extremely comfortable, and they won't break your bank like a lot of other lifting shoes out there. So if you go to barefootathletics.com, and that's B-E-A-R like the animal, and use the code SQUATU, you can get 10% off your order today. On today's episode, I had the awesome opportunity to sit down with Stan Efferding. Now, if you don't know Stan, he is the founder of The Vertical Diet and is a wealth of knowledge when it comes to all things nutrition and training. So you guys are in for a real treat today. I really think you're going to enjoy today's episode. Let's get to it. Stan, I just want to start by saying thank you for taking time out of your busy day to come on my show. I know that you're in the middle of a huge seminar trip right now, so thank you so much. Most of the time when I have someone on the show, I start off by just asking them to give a brief introduction of themselves. I would say most of my listeners to the Squat University podcast know who Stan Efferding is, so I want to dive a little bit deeper. I want to actually go back to the origin story of how the vertical diet started. How did it come about? How did you come from sort of re-examining what you were doing back in the day to coming to formulate what you now teach?
Yeah. Hey, well, first of all, thanks for having me on. Huge respect to you and what you do. We're so blessed at this day and the age to have access to information like yours. We didn't have the internet whenever I was starting out. My first competition was in 1986. So I've been at this a while, and boy, what I could have done, I always say if I knew then what I know now, with all the great information that's currently out there, and you're a huge part of that, so I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm up in, where am I? Near Topeka, Kansas, as part of my 60 cities and 60 day tour in cooperation with the FitOps Foundation. And I picked up Bobby Summers, Sergeant Bobby Summers, Purple Heart recipient, Iraqi war veteran, and he's just jumped in on my seminar up in, I think it was Wichita, and he's going to go with me for the rest of the tour now. So we're a team. I'm at Olympic Barbell. I just finished training. That's why I look like a hot mess. My hair is all messed up. Just did some squats with my old business partner and my old training partner, Keith Williams, for IFBB Pro. So great day here, and we were using the Mars bar. Man, it's my new favorite bar. I saw you.
Yep, I've used it before.
Yep, used it before. I saw your report on it. I bought one. I freaking love it because I'm a huge ass squatter, you know. So anyhow, to go back to your original question, you know, it's kind of the culmination of everything I've learned from over 30 years of competing, obviously college, studying exercise science at the University of Oregon, being a coach, being coached by great coaches, and collaborations with athletes that I've learned a lot from, and of course, you know, academics and professionals like yourself. For 30 years, I've been screaming and yelling about these restrictive diets that you see all these bikini girls using. I've been training women since the late 80s, men and women both. for competition, bodybuilding figure, physique, bikini. And I've just been trying to scream out as loud as I can against these over-restrictive egg white tilapia broccoli diets mm-hmm. and the havoc that it wreaks on their bodies, the amenorrhea, the anemia, the hair loss, the hypothyroidism, the rebounds with the edema and all of the depression and the fat gain. All of those things are just painful to me. And unfortunately, with the expansion of this industry, we've got more and more gurus still selling that same horrible diet program. And sadder yet is that the general public has started to look at these bikini competitors in the best shape of their life and then try and emulate their diet programs. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the general public doesn't have the advantage of taking Anavar to prevent the muscle loss and thyroid because of the hypothyroidism and clenbuterol to deal with, you know, the metabolic adaptation. So they're just getting wrecked by these diets. And I've been trying to speak out against it for a long, long time. I'm just one small voice. And so when I was able to work with some very high-profile athletes, Hafþór Bjørnsson, of course, Brian Shaw, worked with Larry Wheels, Dan Green. I mean, I've worked with so many great athletes, NFL great Lane Johnson, and then some Olympia women, Nadia Wyatt, and some CrossFit national champions, Becca Voigt, Camille LeBlanc, Ben Smith. I started to get a bigger voice in the industry. Of course, all of my work with Mark Bell has provided me a great platform, and I wanted to use it positively to influence the people who I think are being wrecked by these diets. And so I put together the Vertical Diet. The branding of it allowed me to reach a broader audience, and I put that out into the public domain, and we now have over 100,000 unique users accessing the diet from all over the world. And it really preaches about using highly micronutrient dense, bioavailable foods that are easy to digest. And then, you know, using those foods to build a platform for performance. And in that way, I've been able to remedy a lot of things, such as I mentioned earlier, sleep apnea, the female triad. People feel better and stronger. Things like keeping sodium in the diet, keeping iodine in the diets, not excluding red meat because the iron and B12 and how important that is for women. Don't take out fruit because that's also very important. All the things that your traditional guru would tell you to exclude. Dairy products for calcium, which is not just important for bones, but it's also important for nerve signaling and muscle contraction. So it's really just a more sensible diet plan. It kind of starts out as a low FODMAP diet because I see so many digestive disorders in the industry on both ends of the spectrum between the dieters and the weight gainers who experience metabolic syndrome in many cases from insulin resistance and high blood pressure. So I deal with athletes on both ends of the spectrum, and I think they're both done themselves a disservice by trying to utilize these guru diets that have been in the industry. So I hope that kind of gives you a bit of a background.
Yeah. Take me back to when you first started talking to the world about your ideas on nutrition. How were things originally perceived? Obviously, I'm sure, you know, you talking about micronutrients, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but the way in which people should be eating was very against the mainstream belief, I'm sure, especially in the bodybuilding and fitness world. What were some of the first reactions to your new advices on nutrition?
Well, it's been overwhelmingly positively received because people realize almost immediate benefits in all of the areas that I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with such great athletes that I think they have the confidence. A lot of times, you know, overcoming some, you know, their predispositions is half the battle, you know, as you see with the placebo effect. And as long as I can gain their confidence, and that's why I recruited a co-author that's a PhD in exercise phys and a registered dietitian who was head of the dietetic department at UNLV to go through this diet with me and to sign on with it and create 200 peer-reviewed published articles to attach supporting the science of every aspect of the diet, because I knew overcoming those myths and those long-held beliefs in the industry was going to be challenging. So generally speaking, the only opposition I get is from people who have ethical positions with respect to eating animal foods, which would be your PETA organization and your vegans. But I work with vegans. I have dieters that are on vegan diets, carnivore diets, keto diets. I've trained them for competition. And, you know, I've always said that the best diet's the one you'll follow, and compliance is the science. And so if they express to me that they want to eat a certain way and they feel good that way, then I work around that with all the other important aspects, such as sleep and hydration, digestion, hormones. So there's so many more things other than just the food. And so I've been received very well, but for people who maybe dietitians who are vegetable-based don't like to see so much animal food consumption, and particularly red meat, because it's been demonized so horribly. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, in the last 5 years, we've had a lot of really smart folks expose the deficiency of the epidemiology, including Dr. John Ioannidis, who's been recently in the news as a result of his coming out against the predictions for the 2 million deaths from COVID, when he said it wouldn't be more than about 140,000. And as it turns out, he's correct. He's the godfather of meta research, and he came in and said that epidemiology is really not a good method to study nutrition. And that's what the NutriRec study also showed us, that very comprehensive study on the IARC, the World Health Organization recommendations against red meat. And we just find that the epidemiology is weak, and that you can have a very healthy, a comparatively healthy diet that's meat-based, whole food meat-based, as you can whole food vegetable-based. They have similar outcomes when you exclude all of the lifestyle factors that might come along with people eating red meat, but also eating fries and Cokes and mayonnaise and stuff like that. So it's been very well received. We've had extraordinary success in terms of maintaining health for women who suffer from all the maladies I just mentioned, mm-hmm. and extraordinary success with powerlifters and strongmen who have a high blood pressure, high blood sugars. We've had 100% success rate at reducing systolic blood pressure significantly, 10 to 30 points in many cases. So the proof's in the pudding. I've lived it. I've had over 150 blood tests. I've been up over 300 pounds many, many times throughout my career, and I've been down to 4% body fat or thereabouts. So I've been a professional dieter all my life, bulking up, dieting down, bulking up, dieting down. I learned a lot of lessons along the way. That's my N of one. Those are my anecdotes. And then I've worked with hundreds and hundreds of athletes now and thousands of clients all over the world. Those are my testimonials. And we've bounced this up against the literature, a lot of randomized controlled trials, and we think we have a very solid program that we have get excellent response from. So I've been overwhelmingly pleased. I've been blessed that it's achieved the notoriety that it has. It just kind of went viral, kind of on the back of some of the great athletes, Hafþór Björnsson and others. People, as I mentioned earlier, they tend to trust when something is working for someone, and then when they try it and they see the results, I think that's just more confirmation that this is a simple, sensible, and sustainable solution that's a lifestyle for people and not just some sort of short-term thing.
And I think what you said right there, it really makes a big dent for people, is saying it's a lifestyle. Even though it has the name diet attached to it, I think so many people nowadays, when they hear the word diet, they're like, all right, well, this is something I'm just going to do for a couple months. I'm going to get to where my goal is, or that's yep. drop 30 pounds, gain a little bit of muscle, and then I'll go back to doing whatever I want. But really, diet should be a lifestyle thing. It shouldn't be something that you just go on for a few yep. months. It should be something that you should sustain. And obviously the reason why so many people have that idea in their mind is why we see so many issues with yo-yo dieting, and then issues also with all the things that you have seen with their people's attachment to food and the way in which they eat. One of the things that I wanted to lay a little bit of context for the listeners out there who may not really know too much about nutrition. One of the main parts of the vertical diet is the distinction between macronutrients and micronutrients, and obviously the importance of understanding the details of each. Can you just give a simple definition of macro versus micronutrients and why it's important to understand the importance of the two?
Sure. And most people have heard of if it fits your macros, mm-hmm. and that's certainly be a reasonable way to move towards a better diet than the standard American diet, by all means. And those are your calorie based, that's your proteins, your fats, and your carbohydrates. Unfortunately, for a lot of the people that I work with, after many years of dieting either to gain or lose weight, we find that they have some micronutrient deficiencies. And if you don't satisfy those, then the diet long term will fail, usually because you either end up getting hungry or tired or suffering from some sort of deficiency, like I mentioned earlier. more specifically, the typical, let's say, just the bikini diet. We'll go on the dieter's side. Mm-hmm. They would typically eat egg whites, tilapia, and broccoli. Well, in the absence of the yolk, you don't have biotin. Biotin's good for your skin, hair, and nails. The abidin in the white robs biotin from your body. So that's why you end up with the brittle hair and all of those problems. When you choose tilapia or even boneless, skinless chicken breast instead of red meat, then you end up deficient in iron. Red meat has 3 times the iron, 6 times the B12, and 9 times the zinc of chicken. In a good, better, best scenario, steak is by far better in terms of its micronutrient content and digestibility, and even its omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, being 3 to 1, as opposed to chickens who eat soy and have a monogastric digestive system. They have a 17 to 25 to 1 omega-6 to omega-3 ratio. It's an inferior micronutrient source. It may satisfy your macronutrient demands for protein, but that's not the be-all, end-all of eating food. The cofactors within that food can have a significant impact on performance. Studies on egg whites compared to whole eggs, where they equate for protein, this was in men over 50, I believe, they had a significantly better hypertrophy response and a very substantially better strength response from eating whole eggs than eating egg whites. So protein wasn't just the only determining factor there. The summary by the authors of that study suggested that the micronutrients matter. And of course, we believe that here. Same is true with the chicken as compared to steak, as I mentioned. And then we get down to what kind of vegetables you're going to eat. And in many cases, people stuff themselves full of broccoli to suppress appetite and may feel there's other, you know, vitamins and antioxidant benefits. Unfortunately, it can cause digestive distress. I mentioned FODMAPs earlier, the fermentable oligo dye, monosaccharides, and polyols. I see a lot of dieters have trouble with IBS, IBD, you know, gastric distress, and maybe a host of other autoimmune disorders, Hashimoto's and Crohn's disease. Those are generally aggravated by digestive disorders and can be significantly improved by using a low FODMAP diet. And that's been scientifically studied to show a 60 to 80% improvement in digestive distress in most users. So I use that low FODMAP diet. Broccoli in excess, which is typically what's prescribed in these bikini diets. And again, it's individualistic, it's dose dependent, how it's prepared matters, and it has a cumulative effect as well, how often you eat. It's like your body has kind of a limit to how much of certain FODMAPs it can handle, things like sugar alcohols or lectins, those kinds of things. I don't think that they're bad for you necessarily. It's dose dependent, and the individual, their digestion matters. So it blocks iodine as well, the cruciferous vegetables. And usually dieters do a couple things that really hurt their performance. They will cut out sodium, or just by eating whole foods and not eating any fast food and packaged food, which is a good thing, they've dramatically limited their sodium intake. And then if they salt using only pink salt or iodized salt, or not iodized, but pink salt or sea salt, there's no iodine in them. And then they compound that by eating a ton of cruciferous vegetables, and they inhibit iodine absorption. Next thing you know, their thyroid starts to slow. And that can raise cholesterol, it can raise blood pressure, it can cause them to get cold hands and feet and brain fog and a host of other problems, in addition to compounding the effects of the lack of biotin and causing hair loss. And they get very tired. So they have a really hard time with their non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which we know is the largest contributor to calorie consumption in dieters. It's the one that you can manipulate the best for controlling weight loss. There's not a whole lot you can do with your basal metabolic rate. It's not a whole lot you can do with your exercise activity after a certain point, and that could be detrimental. And your thermic effect of food, of course, is going to decline based on eating less food. But generally speaking, those are the foods that I opt to use. I add the salt, I add the iodine, I add the red meat, I add the whole eggs, I add some dairy. We mentioned earlier, if you can't handle milk, you might go with a Greek yogurt. It's much more tolerable, and then it's dose dependent. You can use smaller amounts. And then finally, a cheddar cheese is low in lactose if you can't handle the other two. And that provides the calcium that I mentioned earlier is hugely important. I do supplement 2 things that are hard to get from diet. One is vitamin D3. I'd prefer if they got it from sun. Vitamin D3 is more of a proxy marker for poor health than it is something that can just be supplemented to make up for it. But in a deficiency, it does help to get vitamin D3. It increases calcium absorption by up to 20-fold, and that can definitely be significant. And the other one's magnesium. Again, hard to get from food. So put 400 milligrams of magnesium with dinner, and that can generally help with vasodilation and a host of other health factors. So that pretty much, other than salmon twice a week to get your DHA, handles the foundation. Some fruits, I'd absolutely put fruit in there. For dieters, I use high satiety foods. If you look at a satiety index that describes how long certain foods keep people full, protein obviously is one, fiber is one, but at the top end of that index is a whole potato and an orange. And they also have the extra benefit of being loaded with potassium, which when I put salt in my athletes' diets, I want to also put in adequate potassium to maintain water balance. And those two things together just make them feel incredibly better in terms of performance.
I know you mentioned salt there, and I know you've talked on many podcasts in length about this, but for those of that haven't heard your discussions on this before, how much are we recommending an athlete put into their diet that they don't already?
Okay. Let's talk that through, because sodium is very important for many, many things, for performance, for stamina, for endurance. It can be a huge contributor for relieving brain fog and dizziness. If your mom gets up from a seated position and is dizzy, or if you have a client that gets off the leg press and stands up and feels dizzy, just a quarter teaspoon of salt before training completely eliminates that problem. Here's the challenge with salt, is it too has been demonized over the years. And Dr. Nick DiLantonio has written a book called The Salt Fix that goes into this in great detail. Also, the PEER study, Dr. Salem Youssef, cardiologist of the World Heart Federation, has done the largest and most comprehensive study on sodium intake in the world. And they also tested urinary excretion of sodium, so it's more than just an epidemiological study. They have some actual measurements. They demonstrated that an intake of sodium between 3 to 6 grams was a healthy dose of sodium to take in. Now, mind you, that's not salt. Salt is 40% sodium and 60% chloride. And that's also important for digestion. Sodium chloride, hydrochloric acid. So it's a huge component for so many things in the body. So if he's recommending 3 to 6 grams of sodium, then say 5 grams of sodium is going to be about 12 grams of salt a day. That would be a healthy average for the general population worldwide. He also noticed and reported in that study that when you get under 3 grams of sodium a day, you have a dramatic increase in all-cause mortality. So it's not beneficial. He specifically pointed out the American Heart Association and the DASH diet as being adverse for general health. He mentioned that if you are hypertensive, if you have a genetic predisposition for elevated blood pressure, you do not see an increase in all-cause mortality until you start to get over 7 grams a day of sodium. And even then, it's a much more gradual curve as compared to that of the all-cause mortality for those below 3 grams a day. The reason that's really important is because when you get people below 3 grams a day, they start to get very tired and brain fog and dizzy spells. They just feel terrible. They feel hungry. They get loss of energy. And those are the two biggest factors for why people can't maintain weight loss. In the beginning, we talked about the fact that I mentioned that, you know, all diets work when they're strictly adhered to. Mm-hmm. And the best diet's the one you'll follow. And most people lose weight when they go on a diet. But most people also gain it back eventually. And the two biggest reasons for gaining weight back is because you get hungry and you get tired. It's not a lifestyle that's sustainable. And so we try and mitigate the hunger and the energy by increasing and improving sleep. By adding sodium is very important, by making sure that the hormones are supported, like the iodine for the thyroid. The adequate sleep improves the testosterone levels. The vitamins and minerals I mentioned in all of those foods that I suggest help people just have more energy and be less hungry so they can stay on the diet and perform better in the gym if it's a competitive environment. So back to salt, only a small percentage of people who are hypertensive would be adversely affected by sodium intake over 7 grams a day. And even that curve flattened out when you got adequate potassium into those people, 4,700 milligrams a day. And that's hard to do. You have to be deliberate about it. That's why I throw in a daily potato. I throw in some fruit. There's 100 milligrams of potassium in every ounce of meat, some yogurt. Mixing all those together with possibly some low-gas vegetables like spinach or squash or cucumber, daily carrot. That can get your potassium up to north of 4,000 milligrams a day, and you'll feel much better, and so will your joints as well. We know that people with arthritis rheumatoid arthritis in particular, when they get their potassium up, they have much better joint integrity, along with heart arrhythmia, hunger even, because potassium binds to glucose to form glycogen. It has such an enormous effect on the body. Now, your normotensive people, people who don't respond adversely to sodium intake, they don't seem to have any adverse effects when they get up to 7, 8, 9, 10 grams. Their body can process it quite easily. The Japanese, and even us before refrigeration, we're packing our food in salt. And the Japanese in particular, eat a lot of fish. They have a 3 times the sodium intake that we do. So now it becomes a matter of the user's individual need. Are they a big athlete? Do they sweat a lot? Are they a salty sweater? Because different people sweat out at different rates. Dr. Sandra Godick, who runs the Heat Institute, she's a PhD in thermal regulation and hydration. She does sweat tests for the Philadelphia Eagles in particular, and I work with Lane Johnson, the offensive lineman for Philadelphia. And he sweats out 5 grams of sodium an hour. It's an enormous sweater. This is one of the first things I addressed with him, and he had the test, of course. I've used Sandra's office in the past to help with Ben Smith when he had heat stroke a month before CrossFit Nationals, and to send patch tests to Brian Shaw to see if we could develop a hydration protocol, which is really just that Sandra gave us with the sodium and potassium in particular. Mm-hmm. Her recommendation is that you salt food to taste, that your tongue will tell you. Okay. It's not a positive feedback loop. It's actually a negative feedback loop. When you get too much, your tongue will be averse to the extra. So we salt every meal to taste, primarily because you can't put adequate sodium into water and be able to drink it. It wouldn't be palatable. It's diluted to such a degree that you don't get the physiological benefit. It's another reason why carrying around a gallon of water and sucking it down every chance you get can actually dilute sodium from the body and other minerals and be ineffective. So we add it to food. I certainly would recommend people to drink water to taste as well. That's what Sandra recommends. Drink when you're thirsty. That's the recommendation from the PhDs. But have it available so that you know, you don't have to wait. And she also says that to add 500 milligrams of sodium before and after training. This is consistent with the recommendations of the International Society of Sports Nutrition and that of the NSCA. And I've given, easily 1,000 milligrams before and after training to some of the athletes, the CrossFitters in particular, or the salty sweaters, or in hot climates like where the World's Strongest Man was in Florida or Manila, to the big athletes like Hofthor and Brian Shaw. That's a half teaspoon, right? Not a tablespoon of salt. It's a very small amount when you look at it, 500 to 1,000 milligrams. It has a dramatic effect on performance. Camille, over 5 days of competing in the Reebok Championships, gained a pound of body weight, which is extraordinary. That was, previously she had always lost weight and a lot of energy, and of course, you just don't perform as well. But if you can maintain adequate sodium consumption, I take it as a pre-workout. I work out longer, harder. I can sweat more. I don't get tired. I don't hit the wall. My performance is dramatically improved as a result of that. And I recommend it to all of my athletes.
Now, how are you taking that pre-workout?
You can use just a quarter teaspoon of table salt and put it on your tongue and drink it.
Okay.
I don't like the way it tastes.
Yeah.
So I just use something called Thermotabs or any kind of salt tablet. And I just pop them, and drink them with some water about 30 minutes before training.
Interesting.
It's life changing. It has a very dramatic effect on performance. And so I recommend it for all of my athletes, hypertensive or not. A hypertensive individual who overconsumes sodium may have a measurable increase in systolic blood pressure of about 2 to 7 millimeters. Not terribly significant when you consider that something like sleep apnea might increase systolic blood pressure by 20 millimeters. And something like hypothyroidism, particularly in women, this has been studied extensively, hypothyroid versus normal thyroid women, can also be a 20-point difference in systolic blood pressure. And again, I mentioned that when you get adequate potassium, then that increase goes away even in hypertensives. So I don't focus on sodium when it comes to blood pressure. We've had 100% success rate, I may have mentioned earlier, in reducing blood pressure in our athletes. But I don't start with sodium. I start with getting adequate potassium. I actually start with the CPAP, and I go to thyroid function improvement. And then I do the 10-minute walks to decrease insulin levels, which contribute to high blood pressure. Blood sugars, of course, do. And that would take us into a whole nother conversation about the metabolic syndrome in big athletes. But that's kind of my wrap on salt in general. I was attacked pretty viciously by the medical community when I came out with that rant a few years ago. And lo and behold, some of these same people that used to criticize me are now also referencing Dr. DiNicolantonio's work in their salt recommendations. And of course, I mentioned the ISSN and the NSCA have the same recommendations. So I don't apologize for that. The recommendations I made were based on high-performance athletes in hot environments that train hard and sweat a lot. And of course, those have to be adjusted based on the individual.
Now, I know you mentioned practically taking the tab before 30 minutes before training and then also salting any of your food to taste. Are there any other practical recommendations you can give an athlete to ensure that they're hitting the recommended amount of sodium in their diet?
That's the primary driver right there. Okay. You might, instead of doing 500 milligrams before, you might have to do 1,000 if you're a bigger athlete in a hot environment.
Gotcha.
In between meals, if you're drinking water, you could pop a salt tablet with it. You could wake up and take 500 milligrams of sodium upon waking with some water, which would be, you know, a half hour before breakfast or maybe, or an hour before breakfast. Interestingly enough, you could also take 500 milligrams or a quarter teaspoon or three thermotabs before bed. And it has the added advantage of it increases the release of anti-diuretic hormone, which helps suppress urine creation so you don't have to get up and pee in the middle of the night.
Interest.
Which is a common problem also with people with sleep apnea because they don't get into stage three REM sleep, which is when the anti-diuretic hormone is released. So they find themselves getting up every few hours to pee because they're still producing urine all night instead of getting the anti-diuretic hormone that's supposed to suppress that activity. So those are two ways to curb that problem.
Yeah, that's interesting. One of the big questions that I had, I have a lot of power lifters and strongmen that I work with currently, getting them through some injuries. And one of the big questions a lot of them always have is, how do I successfully add weight? How do I bulk safely and cleanly, I guess we'll say. I mean, I know the traditional way of bulking, and I know you have a lot of experience in this in the past, is, you know, we would dirty bulk. I know personally myself, for the longest time, I was an 85-kilo weightlifter. And man, I could not gain weight. And I was always told, being 5'11 and 85 kilo weightlifter, I'm head and shoulders above everyone at a national weightlifting meet. So I was told, man, you got to get up to the 94 kilo weight class, which is 207. Right. So I did what everyone told me. I'm eating ice cream every single night. I'm eating Stouffer's lasagna, just dirty bulking as much as possible. Got up in weight and I didn't lift any better. My performance was better. I just had a lot of bad weight on me. So
what is
your recommendation when you hear someone ask that question?
You know, I smile and I laugh because I've lived this, my friend. I've lived this for 30 years. I did the go mad. I did the frozen pizzas with the extra cheese on top at night before bed. I did the huge, whole milk shakes with ice cream and peanut butter. And they were the size of the blender and you'd suck it down so fast and it'd be so cold that you'd throw it right back up. And then you discover that throwing up an ice cream milkshake tastes pretty good when it comes out of your nose. But then you discover that you didn't get the calories. So now you have to make another one and drink another one right behind it. So, you know, I've done it all, my friend, and I've had over 150 blood tests throughout my career. And I've watched what happened to my body and my performance as a result of gaining weight the wrong way and gaining weight the right way. Mm-hmm. I've been a 140-pound guy in college. I competed in my first bodybuilding show as 158 pounds. Wow. And I was jamming down protein like crazy, thinking I was going to get big on protein. Mm-hmm. I learned so many lessons along the way. And this is one of the things, of course, I specialize in working with big athletes or even hard gainers. They both have a similar problem, eating enough food. And so their diet is very different than the diet I use, of course, with the athletes that are losing weight. It's the same fundamentals, the same nutrient-dense foundation of foods to get them all their micronutrients. But I have to use easier to digest foods with them. That's why I like the FODMAP. So if I've got a hard gainer, I'll actually lower his protein intake to like 0.8 grams per pound because it has a high thermic effect of food and it's very satiating. It makes it hard to eat enough food. And in a calorie surplus, particularly with a lot of carbohydrates, those are muscle sparing. You're not going to break down a lot of muscle tissue. So don't be alarmed when I reduce the protein on an athlete that's trying to gain or a big athlete. It won't sacrifice any muscle tissue and it has a very good effect on gaining weight. And then I also keep fats reasonably low. They tend to digest a little slower and fill you up. And once you get past a certain point with fats, they don't contribute to any of the processes that are good for anabolism. They're great for health. You know, they facilitate the transfer of nutrients in and out of the cells. Every cell has a fatty membrane. You get your A, D, E, and K in there. I love fats. You know, I love saturated fats. I love cholesterol. Those are all the things that, I've been talking about for many years. And I come to find out that cholesterol is now removed from the dietary guidelines as a nutrient of concern. So, you know, it all comes back around if you hang out long enough. And I don't pretend to have invented it. Vince Guaraldi was talking about this stuff in the 1960s. He was telling Arnold to eat red meat and whole eggs and even eat sea kelp for iodine. So I've just been screaming and saying, hey, what happened? Where did we steer off this road? And why are we hurting these athletes? So my hard gainers and my big athletes, that's a couple of the methods that I use. I keep fats a little lower. I keep protein a little lower. Then I drive carbs. And the workload drives the process. I can feed them about as much carbs as they're willing to move. So I can shuttle those carbs into muscle, and the carbohydrates hold on to three parts water, which is 70% sodium. And it just creates an anabolic environment. Having a lot of carbohydrates in the muscle cell itself, the sarcoplasmic reticulum, increases the calcium release, which increases muscle fiber contraction, all of the things that contribute to better performance. And ultimately, an extra rep or an extra set over time will accumulate in the benefits that they're looking for, strength or size. One of the neat tricks I use now in driving carbohydrates is I avoid pizza, pasta, and pancakes. I avoid the high FODMAP stuff, the grains, the things that will fill you up and bloat you and give you diarrhea possibly, and because of the massive doses. I've worked with a lot of athletes that have had registered dietitians give them diets that have 3 and 4 and 5 cups of quinoa a day, thinking they're doing something healthy. You can't eat that in any significant portion for any period of time. So I drive white rice. Once I've satisfied their micronutrient requirements with, I said, the fruit and the dairy, the yogurt and the potato, and I get them all of the micronutrients they need, the potassium, etc. Then I drive white rice to fuel a calorie surplus and workload, a 2-a-day CrossFitter, a 400-plus-pound guy. They need a lot of calories. Hofthor eats 1,200 grams of just white rice a day. That's almost 5,000 calories.
Wow.
Sometimes that can be hard to do. The body can't digest that much starch even in that simple form, just from a lack of amylase production in the pancreas, so just not enough. So I have them sprinkle a little bit of dextrose on the rice. That not only helps with the mechanical process of just eating that amount of rice, more amylase in the mouth, more saliva, just being able to swallow and consume that much food. It's much easier when I sprinkle a little dextrose on there, not to drive calories, but just mechanically to make it easier to eat. And then the dextrose can stimulate the pancreas to release more amylase and help with the starch digestion. So they can eat more, be hungrier sooner, eat more often, and get the amount of calories in that they need. I throw the 10-minute walks in. Everybody's heard me bark about these. They're extraordinary for improving digestion, increasing digestive enzymes. And they'll absolutely be able to have less gas, less bloating, digest their food better, and be hungrier sooner, increases their metabolism, helps improve insulin sensitivity. It's twice as effective as metformin, the number one prescription drug in the world for diabetes control. 3 10-minute walks a day is twice as effective. It's been measured and studied in controlling diabetes and increasing insulin sensitivity. So I use that to draw glucose out of the bloodstream without the need of insulin right into the muscles. There's a pathway that allows that to happen without raising insulin too high. And the reason I want to be careful how high I raise the insulin, now we're on to metabolic syndrome with my heavy athletes, is because once they start getting some insulin resistance, then the sugars that they consume, the carbohydrates that they consume, get converted more easily into triglycerides in the liver. Then they get fatty liver, more insulin resistance. It's kind of a snowball effect. And what happens to them is what Thor brought to me 4 years ago. He said, Stan, I'm getting fatter. I'm not getting stronger. And that's what you just described, is that you start packing on all this weight, but it's not muscle mass. Probably because we're way too high in fat to begin with, but also because we might not have the ideal metabolic environment to digest and absorb these carbohydrates. There's a couple other things I do to save the liver and to keep it more efficient longer with these weight gain. Sometimes I'll periodize their weight like I do their training. I'll have them lose 7 to 10% of their total body weight. That's a hard thing to tell a strongman or a powerlifter to do.
Yeah.
Hofgaard has done it religiously over the last 4 years. You've seen him come down to from 435 or 450 into the high 300s, 380, 390. What we found is, and what the science supports, is that losing 10% of your body weight can resolve 95% of your fatty liver as tested with biopsies. So you don't have to lose, you don't have to have a six pack. A 300 pound person can diet down to 270 and cure 95% of their fatty liver and become insulin sensitive. And it starts happening right away, even with like a 3% loss. Within a few days or a week, you start to absorb glucose better simply from weight loss and a little bit of calorie restriction and moving a little bit. So usually I try and get them to drop weight. If that opportunity doesn't exist or in concurrently with dropping weight, I'll have them consume at least 1,000 milligrams of choline a day. That's very protective for the liver and can help reverse fatty liver. I do that with eggs, six eggs a day. Whole eggs is 1,000 milligrams of choline. I also like to avoid vegetable oils. It's my opinion, and there's some there's four randomized controlled trials that are very comprehensive that have demonstrated that long-term vegetable oils can increase all-cause mortality when compared to saturated fats. But specifically to insulin resistance, the oxidation of lots of vegetable oils, seed oils, so canola, cottonseed, soybean, safflower, sunflower, those kinds of corn oil, the oxidation in the liver helps or creates an environment that glycates the sugars much more quickly and converts them into triglycerides. So I think that it compounds the problem and speeds up the fatty liver process. We've seen this in some pretty comprehensive studies, the difference between people who consume a lot of vegetable oils versus saturated fats and their susceptibility to alcohol-related fatty liver. And it's also true in non-alcohol-related fatty liver. I might throw an extra supplement at them, NAC, N-acetylcysteine, which contributes to glutathione production, and that can help the liver. And if they're having trouble digesting their fats, some TUDCA, T-U-D-C-A, I won't try and pronounce the name of it, that can actually dilate the bile ducts so that bile can get into the gallbladder better and leave the liver, get into the gallbladder better and help with the absorption of some of those fats. All of that provides some release to the liver. One thing I should note when people are trying to find out whether they have some insulin resistance or fatty liver, you can get a blood test and you can look at your fasted glucose, of course, and you can look at your HA1C. Those are lagging indicators. You can have insulin resistance for 10 years and not see an elevation out of the normal range of your fasted glucose and HA1C. What you should look at, the leading indicator, is your fasted insulin level. And often that's not tested for in most skinny tests. I recommend a pretty comprehensive profile for my athletes. And the normal range is anything under 19. I recently worked with Rob Kearney. You saw him on ESPN, set the American record for the log press. And you might have seen yours truly on there, talking about Rob's diet. And one of the things that we did was a blood test. And Rob's fasted insulin was in the normal range, but it was 16. When I see an athlete with insulin above 6, I'm starting to be concerned about some degree of insulin resistance and fatty liver. So the second thing I look at as a leading indicator would be triglycerides, and Rob's were on the high end. Those two things tell me that he's converting glucose into fats in the liver and that he's got some insulin resistance. So we employed all of the strategies that I just mentioned. You won't always see it in your AST-ALT enzymes. Those don't appear in most cases for fatty liver. You'd probably have to get some sort of ultrasound if you wanted to see more specifically. But the recommendations are the same with the high insulin and high triglycerides as they would be if you took the extra step to get the ultrasound. And again, the weight loss itself could cure that in a very short order. So I hope I stayed on topic there with respect to your question and how I remedy for hard gainers and for big athletes who aren't getting bigger, they're just getting fatter. That's the method that I utilize. And in my vertical diet ebook, I have a high blood pressure and a high blood sugar quick fix kit that details all of those things step by step in what I think is a hierarchy and an order of importance, along with the blood test and how to interpret them.
Now, those 3 10-minute walks a day that you recommend, is that any time in particular after a certain meal?
I like to see them after a meal within 10 or 30 minutes, when the muscles move again. I thought it was great what you did recently. I saw one of your your Squat University videos on Instagram, I always recommend people, particularly if they have any sort of squatting injury, to start scrolling through those. It's just amazing the Appreciate information that you provide and how helpful it is. You were talking about recovery from workout, the best way to recover. And I did a video on that some years ago, the best way to recover from workouts. And it's the same fundamental stuff that people tend to overlook. Sleep, hydration, and nutrition, of course. And then you said active recovery. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen is that general movement is as effective as specific therapy for pain relief. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of people, they want to go in, they want to be diagnosed as broken, first of all. Yeah. And then they want to be fixed. And that involves some sort of passive therapy. And while therapy, chiropractics, physical therapy, etc., can be very beneficial for those people who are kinesophobic from some sort of pain or impingement or inability to move, I think that those therapists are facilitators of movement. I think that they provide you the ability to move pain-free, but then you have to move. Yes. And as you said, because you need the lymphatic system to start taking the damage out of the area that you're pumping the blood in to repair. Mm-hmm. And the lymphatic system has no pump. So the 3 10-minute walks for me have been therapeutic for much more than just digestion. It's been for recovery. And what's interesting, and like everything I talk about, I've lived it. I've been through it so many times. I've experienced the alternative. When I used to do a big squat session, I would just lay in bed as much as I could for 2 days. Yeah. And my DOMS would never go away. And then one time, it was probably 11, 12 years ago when I was training with Mark Bell, I had seen something or read something. I don't dream these things up. I'm not the inventor of all this stuff, about the movement and the lymphatic system and all of that. So I got a recumbent bike and I put it in my hotel room that I was mm-hmm. staying in at the time when I was training with Mark. And now I have one in my garage, and I encourage everyone to put one in their, get rid of your recliner and put in a recumbent bike. Hofthorne has one in his garage. And after every meal, he goes out to his garage and he rides for 10 minutes. Well, mm-hmm. After squatting that evening, I would ride that recumbent bike for 10 minutes. I would do like a little mini HIIT session. I would spin for 40 seconds against modest tension. I would rest for 20. And I would do that 10 times. I would get off the bike and I'd have a little mini pump. My knees would be full of blood and my legs. I would start walking like BPAC. Mm-hmm. And it felt pretty good. But there was no eccentric loading. I wasn't creating any damage. I was just mm-hmm. trying to pump a ton of blood in there. And then the next day I would do 3 more. Breakfast, noon and dinner. I've been doing it ever since. And now I alternate between the bike. I'm sorry if I lost you there. Let me get you back.
We're good.
Okay. I alternate between the bike and the walks, but I do them everywhere. And what's really important about them is that they're sustainable. I don't prescribe, 40 minutes of cardio on the treadmill at the gym every night. Mm-hmm. Not only do I think it's not terribly effective for weight loss, but I don't think it's sustainable. And so for me, my goal is that people will be able to comply with whatever I request of them, that it's a lifestyle. That's not enjoyable. The 10-minute walks is something anybody can do anywhere, anytime. Whether, mm-hmm. I'm traveling now, I'll walk around the hotel in the morning. If I'm at the airport, I'll walk around the baggage claim while everybody's standing there. Certainly after dinner every night, I take a walk, whether I'm in a parking lot or at home. If I'm at a restaurant, I'll leave the restaurant, set my timer for 5 minutes, and I'll walk down the street. And then I'll turn around and walk back when my timer goes off, and then I'll get in the car and drive home. Mm-hmm. Of course, on this trip, I probably won't do that in Detroit or Baltimore, but depending on what neighborhood I'm in. But I recommend those, and they're sustainable. It's something anybody can do anytime. The family mm-hmm. does them with me. My son comes in. He's like, "Dad, can we take a walk?" I love it. And it's extremely effective for all the reasons you said. And it has so many great benefits. I think everybody should do them every day for the rest of their lives.
Definitely. And I know it's a big thing too with people who are dealing with back pain. I mean, just my own learning from Dr. Stuart McGill, one of his big things. And you said you were going to JP Price today. And I mean, JP's been doing the walks and it's extremely helpful. It's almost nature's back balm. Just getting up and walking in a quick pace walk actually applies, creates a little bit of a core stability demand on your body when you're swinging your arms. So I know a lot of people know Brian Carroll. He's spoken previously a lot about, and especially in his book, on the benefit of just getting up and taking some walks.
Yes. And yes, so the not gift only of injury.
Exactly.
Gift great of injury. Book. I've read it. Great book. Love that book. Yeah.
Yeah. So extremely helpful, especially when it comes to recovery between heavy training sessions. I know I've put up a lot of different content on recovery, and a lot of people, we automatically think to the expensive things, the massage guns, the NMES units and things like that. And while those have their place, We got to get the fundamentals first. Just like you talk about with nutrition, it's fundamentals first.
Yes.
And it's making sure that we're hitting the basics. And if you don't have that, a lot of things that you do over the top, they're not really going to stick, and you're not going to find the benefits at the end.
Agreed. And my quote has been, and was in my video, things that are done to you or for you are rarely as effective as things you do for yourself. And so I try and always remember that when, even when Eric Spoto got shoulder surgery and they sent him home with one of those machines that moved his arm like this, mm-hmm. and they later discovered through research that passive movement is not as effective as active movement. Mm-hmm. And so they've stopped prescribing those. And my old business partner had a knee surgery, and they put him in one of those game readies. And he used it every day religiously for a month. The doctor told him, you got to stop using that thing because he wasn't recovering. The ice was preventing the necessary acute inflammatory response that mm-hmm. Affords all the repair to be done. So
exactly.
You know that, especially as the professional that you are, that really what your job is to facilitate movement. And then the hard mm-hmm. part, like coaches say to me every time I go to a high school or something, they say, man, if I could just get them to eat and sleep. So you get them in yeah. your office and you get them feeling good. But then you know that most people are going to go home and sit down, and they're not going to move and realize the benefit of the facilitation that you did for them.
Exactly. I put out some content recently just on the topic of ice baths, and a lot of people were like, well, what about hot baths? What about, sitting in the hot tub or the sauna? And I'm like, no, you're missing the point. It's not heat versus cold. It's movement versus not movement. And we can facilitate yeah. so much more by just doing the most simple things, getting up, going for a walk, riding the bike for a couple minutes. You're going to speed up and do so much more for your recovery than just sitting in a cold bath. It's we optimize things at the end of the day? It's not that you're hurting yourself doing that, but are you optimizing things at the end of the day? And
right. That
is the topic of diet as well. Can we optimize things and get that much better? The one last question I had for you, I know you've spoken a lot about people getting blood work done and what we can't see from the outside, basically looking deep into the body. For your average person out there that's going to go get their blood work done, you already mentioned the resting glucose levels. What are some other things that you think that are the most important things to look at from your average everyday athlete, coach that are looking at their blood work? What are things that they should be focusing on that they should be able to make a difference in?
Well, athletes, especially heavy athletes or those using performance-enhancing drugs, are going to want to look at your red blood cell, hemoglobin, and hematocrit. Unfortunately, that's a tough topic because sometimes those are slightly elevated. And if you don't also have elevated platelets or ferritin, then you might not want to donate blood to bring those down. Mm-hmm. Those can be elevated due to sleep apnea. Those can be elevated due to living in elevation. Those can be elevated just from your high workload. That's a response that's supposed to be beneficial for your body from training. They can get too high and may need remedied with donation. But I found that people that try to donate too often end up with anemia. They end up with low ferritin or iron storage or low platelets. And they end up being tired and they don't perform well. I never recommend my athletes donate within 30 and possibly 60 days of any competition. If there's some sort of intervention that needs to be done, it should be done after competition because it can adversely affect performance and cardiovascular capabilities when you're training. So that's a big one. Obviously, I mentioned the blood sugars. Those are huge, particularly the leading indicators, fasted insulin and triglycerides. Most people get their cholesterol done. This is the tough one because there's so much information about cholesterol. I will say, generally speaking, the total cholesterol and LDL cholesterol are not good predictors of future cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. You want to look at your triglyceride to HDL ratio. And if you have a concern about those numbers, those are the ones that the triglycerides in particular that are affected by high insulin. Control blood sugars, those will come down. Optimize thyroid function. Those cholesterol numbers will plummet. People who have hypothyroidism will significantly elevated cholesterol numbers. So trying to do something like take fish oil is not going to have a very significant effect. It's a kind of a waste of time, really, in comparison to things like thyroidism, hypothyroidism, and high blood sugars. Artificially elevating HDL doesn't seem to have a benefit. Taking things like niacin, etc., just hasn't been shown to have a preventative benefit. If your triglyceride to HDL ratio is less than 2:1, probably in a good position. If you're still concerned, I have them get a CAC. Coronary artery calcification test. Ivor Cummins has talked about this extensively over the last many years, and I've certainly had one of those as well. I'm a bit of a hypochondriac. I've had every test imaginable, and I used the blood test to kind of monitor my body and how it responded to, you know, different protocols when I was gaining or losing weight or whatever diet I was on, etc. And there's some other good ones in there. Obviously, your liver and kidney enzymes, your creatinine, your AST, ALT, but those are oftentimes elevated just by training itself. And so you have to be cautious about maybe not training too hard within 2 or 3 days of a blood test so those can normalize. Maybe even just getting enough adequate water so that your creatinine isn't too elevated when you go in to get a blood test. Hydration really helps with those numbers. Those are important. I like to look at thyroid function, and most people only look at TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone. That's got a broad range, and if it's in the higher end of the range and somebody says it's normal, you may still have low free T3 and free T4 and maybe reverse thyroid problems. And if you don't get a test, you don't know. And thyroid can be a significant thing to improve that can help so many things, as we discussed earlier. And it might just be an iodine deficiency. It might be some sleep apnea, and it might be overtraining. Those are the, you know, I don't recommend that everybody runs right in and gets hormone replacement therapy when they see these numbers low or high. And like with testosterone as well, might be low. But it might be low because of sleep apnea. I see that in a lot of 20-some-year-old firemen who get poor sleep. They present with low T. And so there could be an intervention that might help remedy that without the need of supplementation. Yeah, there's a host of other, I have a whole list in the Vertical Diet ebook of all the things that, that I recommend, and along with instructions on how to do that online through private MD labs if you don't have a doctor. It's about a $300 test. It's very comprehensive. It's multiple pages. It's a whole lot of stuff. But on the top of my head right now, I've kind of exhausted to see what else I could toss out that's of any benefit. But and you just go online and you purchase one of these tests. They email you a requisition form. You take it down to the nearest Quest lab. And they'll email you the results in a few days. And then you try and get a professional to analyze those. I'm partners with you know, Damon, who's an RDN, and he's clinically trained and can certainly review those numbers. I advise people on what I would do in a similar circumstance. I still got you there?
Good. Yep.
Okay. I advise people what to do in a similar circumstance, but I stay in my lane. I recommend you know, medical doctors, but I recommend doctors who were familiar with some of those specific things, because I've been misadvised over the years by a general practitioner and then subsequently gone to an endocrinologist who would tell me, no, that's not a concern. Here's what you need to look at. You know, somebody goes in and they've got high total cholesterol and the doctor wants to put them on statins, but they've got a 1-to-1 HDL to triglyceride ratio, and HDL's in the 60s or 70s, which is protective, and no CAC, coronary artery calcification, zero score. That's not a candidate for statins. And so it's frustrating. I had a guy that was dumping blood every 30 days, and his endocrinologist told him to. He contacted me because he was exhausted. His ferritin was low, and he had sleep apnea. He went back into his endocrinologist and told him he had apnea, and he's like, oh, I don't know why I didn't think of that. I'm not smarter than doctors, not claiming to say that, but sometimes they're focused on one thing, or maybe their practice doesn't specialize. And so I try and refer people to doctors who specialize in those specific areas. And there's, you know, plenty of good, many of those doctors publish lots of good research as well. And I'll just give them a link or refer them to those people. But it can be a, you know, you do got to get second opinions. It can be a bit challenging, to get good advice consistently.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely been something I've been meaning to do myself, because it's always an area that I love looking into. Obviously I spend so much more of my time in the physical movement world of rehab and performance, but definitely, yeah. I have a big interest in learning about, you know, nutrition and how it affects blood work and everything like that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a good hour of talking, and I know you have just given a ton of value to the audience out there that's been listening. So
thank you.
Just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show. I know a lot of the powerlifters I've been training are going to be going crazy when they listen to this, because they're really excited when I told them I was going to be having you on the show. So for those out there that want to learn more about the Vertical Diet, where did they find all the information? And I know also you're on a huge seminar tour right now. Where can people that are in future cities sign up for this event?
It's all at stanefferding.com. The ebook is there. You can download it online. It's 220 pages with over 200 scientific references. It's really easy to follow. I made it for me and my meatneck friends. I give it to all of my athletes. That's the first thing I do, and they follow it to the T. And then the seminar is also on there. You can see every city and date and time. along the way. I've only done four. I've got 56 left to go. We're doing 60 cities in 60 days. I'm going to hit every state and most major cities along the way. That's so awesome. Certainly come by. And I'm doing it in partnership with the FitOps Foundation. They train war veterans to become fitness professionals. And we're working with them to make sure that we get these guys something to focus on. Most of these guys suffer from PTSD, suicidal risk, high suicidal risk, addiction. And we get them trained and give them some value and some worth saving lives here at home because of this obesity epidemic that's been exposed on the, you know, on the tail end of this COVID crisis. We've discovered that, that these comorbidities are more dangerous than we thought. And people with obesity and high blood pressure and high blood sugars and are more susceptible to adverse outcomes. And we'd like to get everybody to participate.
Definitely. Well, hopefully some of the listeners of this show will be able to sign up for future seminars. And definitely everyone listening, go to Stan's website, check out this vertical diet book. I promise it'll be of huge value to you like this podcast has been. So everyone, thank you so much for listening to today's show. If you are listening to this on your phone right now, take a screenshot, put it on Instagram story, tag Stan and Squat University so we can share it and just say thank you for spreading the awareness of this podcast. And there we go. Until next week, guys. Happy squatting.
That's it for today, class, on Squat University by Dr. Aaron Horschig. For more exclusive content, log on to squatuniversity.com.